What is the source for this information? Do you remember Sir Jorah Mormont? Would that I might forget him, Ned said bluntly. The Mormonts of Bear Island were an old house, proud and honourable, but their lands were cold and distant and poor. Sir Jorah had tried to swell the family coffers by selling some poachers to a Tyroshi slaver. As the Mormonts were bannermen to the Starks, his crime had dishonoured the North. Ned had made the long journey west to Bear Island, only to find when he arrived that Jorah had taken ship beyond the reach of ice and the king's justice. 5 years had passed since then. Sir Jorah is now in Pentos, anxious to earn a royal pardon that would allow him to return from exile, Robert explained. Lord Varys makes good use of him. So the slaver has become a spy, Ned said with distaste. He handed the letter back. I would rather he become a corpse. Varys tells me that spies are more useful than corpses, Robert said. Jorah aside, what do you make of his report? Daenerys Targaryen has wed some Dothraki horse lord. What of it? Shall we send her a wedding gift? The king frowned. A knife, perhaps. A good sharp one, and a bold man to wield it. Ned did not feign surprise. Robert's hatred of the Targaryens was a madness in him. He remembered the angry words they had exchanged when Tywin Lannister had presented Robert with the corpses of Rhaegar's wife and children as a token of fealty. Ned had named that murder. Robert called it war. When he had protested that the young prince and princess were no more than babes, his new-made king had replied, I see no babes, only dragonspawn. Not even John Arryn had been able to calm that storm. Eddard Stark had ridden out that very day in a cold rage to fight the last battles of the war alone in the south. It had taken another death to reconcile them, Lyanna's death, and the grief they shared over her passing. This time, Ned resolved to keep his temper. Your Grace, the girl is scarcely more than a child. You are no Tywin Lannister, to slaughter innocents. It was said that Rhaegar's little girl had cried as they dragged her from beneath her bed to face the swords. The boy had been no more than a babe in arms, yet Lord Tywin's soldiers had torn him from his mother's breast and dashed his head against a wall. And how long will this one remain, an innocent? Robert's mouth grew hard. This child will soon enough spread her legs and start breeding more dragonspawn to plague me. Nonetheless, Ned said, the murder of children, it would be vile, unspeakable. Unspeakable? The king roared. What Ares did to your brother Brandon was unspeakable. The way your lord father died, that was unspeakable. And Rhaegar? How many times do you think he raped your sister? How many hundreds of times? His voice had grown so loud that his horse whinnied nervously beneath him. The king jerked the reins hard, quieting the animal, and pointed an angry finger at Ned. I will kill every Targaryen I can lay my hands on, until they are as dead as their dragons, and then I will piss on their graves. Ned knew better than to defy him when the wrath was on him. If the years had not quenched Robert's thirst for revenge, no words of his would help. You can't get your hands on this one, can you? He said quietly. The king's mouth twisted in a bitter grimace. No, gods be caused. Some pox-ridden Pentoshi cheesemonger had her brother and her walled up on his estate with pointy-hatted eunuchs all around them. And now he's handed them over to the Dothraki. I should have had them both killed years ago, when it was easy to get at them. But John was as bad as you. More fool I listened to him. John Arryn was a wise man and a good hand. Robert snorted. The anger was leaving him as suddenly as it had come. This Khal Drogo is said to have 100,000 men in his horde. What would John say to that? He would say that even 1,000,000 Dothraki are no threat to the realm, so long as they remain on the other side of the narrow sea. Ned replied calmly. The barbarians have no ships. They hate and fear the open sea. The king shifted uncomfortably in his saddle. Perhaps. There are ships to be had in the free cities, though. I tell you, Ned, I do not like this marriage. There are still those in the Seven Kingdoms who call me a usurper. Do you forget how many houses fought for Targaryen in the war? They bide their time for now, but give them half a chance. They will murder me in my bed, and my sons with me. If the beggar king crosses with a Dothraki horde at his back, the traitors will join him.
He will not cross, Ned promised. And if by some mischance he does, we will throw him back into the sea.
Once you choose a new warden of the east, the king groaned. For the last time, I will not name the Aaron boy warden. I know that boy's a nephew, but with Targaryens climbing in bed with Dothraki, I would be mad to rest one quart of the realm on the shoulders of a sickly child.
Ned was ready for that. Yet we still must have a warden of the east. If Robert Aaron will not do, name one of your brothers. Stannis proved himself at the siege of Storm's End, surely. He let the name hang there for a moment. The king frowned and said nothing. He looked uncomfortable.
That is, Ned finished, quietly, watching, unless you have already promised the honour to another. For a moment, Robert had the grace to look startled. Just as quickly, the look became annoyance.
What have I had?
It's Jaime Lannister, is it not? Robert kicked his horse back into motion and started down the ridge toward the barrows. Ned kept pace with him. The king rode on, eyes straight ahead.
Yes, he said at last,
a single hard word to end the matter.
Kingslayer, Ned said. The rumours were true, then. He rode on dangerous ground now, he knew.
An able and courageous man, no doubt, he said carefully. But his father is Warden of the West, Robert. In time Sir Jaime will succeed to that honour. No one man should hold both East and West. He left unsaid his real concern, that the appointment would put half the armies of the realm into the hands of the Lannisters.
I will fight that battle when the enemy appears on the field, the king said stubbornly. At the moment Lord Tywin looms eternal as Casterly Rock, so I doubt that Jaime will be succeeding any time soon. Don't vex me about this, Ned. The stone has been set.
Your Grace, may I speak frankly?
I seem unable to stop you, Robert grumbled.
They rode through tall brown grasses. Can you trust Jaime Lannister?
He is my wife's twin, a sworn brother of the King's Guard. His life and fortune and honour are all bound to mine.
As they were bound to Aerys Targaryen, Ned pointed out.
Why should I mistrust him? He's done everything I've ever asked of him. His sword helped me win the throne I sit on.
His sword helped taint the throne you sit on, Ned thought, but he did not permit the words to pass his lips. He swore a vow to protect his king's life with his own. Then he opened that king's throat with a sword.
Seven elves! Someone had to kill Ares,
Robert said, reining his mount to a sudden halt beside an ancient barrow.
If Jaime hadn't done it, it would have been left for you or me.
We were not sworn brothers of the King's Guard, Ned said. The time had come for Robert to hear the whole truth. He decided then and there. Do you remember the trident, Your Grace?
I won my crown there. How should I forget it?
You took a wand from Rhaegar, Ned reminded him. So when the Targaryen hosts broke and ran, you gave the pursuit into my hands. The remnants of Rhaegar's army fled back to King's Landing. We followed. Aerys was in the Red Keep with several thousand loyalists. I expected to find the gates closed to us. Robert gave an impatient shake of his head.
Instead, you found that our men had already taken the city. What of it?
Not our men, Ned said patiently. Lannister men. The line of Lannister flew above the ramparts, not the crowned stag.
and they had taken the city by treachery. The war had raged for close to a year. Lords great and small had flocked to Robert's banners. Others had remained loyal to Targaryen. The mighty Lannisters of Casterly Rock, the Wardens of the West, had remained aloof from the struggle, ignoring calls to arms from both rebels and royalists. Aerys Targaryen must have thought that his guards had answered his prayers when Lord Tywin Lannister appeared before the gates of King's Landing with an army 12,000 strong, professing loyalty. So the Mad King had ordered his last mad act. He had opened his city to the lions at the gate.
"Treachery was a coin the Targaryens knew well," Robert said.
The anger was building in him again.
"Lannister paid them back in kind. It was no less than they deserved. I shall not trouble my sleep over it."
"You were not there," Ned said, bitterness in his voice. Trouble sleep was no stranger to him. He had lived his lies for 14 years, that they still haunted him at night. "There was no honour in that conquest."
"The others take your honour,"
Robert swore.
"What did Targaryen ever know of honour? Go down into your crypt and ask Lyanna about the dragon's honour."
"You avenge Lyanna at the Trident," Ned said, halting beside the king. "Promise me, Ned," she had whispered.
"That did not bring her back."
Robert looked away, off into the grey distance.
"The gods be damned. It was a hollow victory they gave me. A crown. It was the girl I prayed them for. Your sister, safe, and mine again. She was meant to be. I asked you, Ned, what good is it to wear a crown? The gods mock the prayers of kings and cowards alike."
"I cannot answer for the gods, Your Grace, only for what I found when I rode into the throne room that day," Ned said. "Aerys was dead on the floor, drowned in his own blood. His dragon skull stared down from the walls. Lannister's men were everywhere. Jaime wore the white cloak of the King's Guard over his golden armor. I can see him still. Even his sword was gilded. He was seated on the Iron Throne, high above his knights, wearing a helm fashioned in the shape of a lion's head. How he glittered!"
"This is well known,"
the king complained. "I was still mounted. I rode the length of the hall in silence, between the long rows of dragon skulls. It felt as though they were watching me somehow. I stopped in front of the throne, looking up at him. His golden sword was across his legs, its edge red with the king's blood. My men were filling the room behind me. Lannister's men drew back. I never said a word. I looked at him, seated there on the throne, and I waited. At last, Jaime laughed and got up. He took off his helm, and he said to me, 'Have no fear, Stark. I was only keeping it warm for our friend Robert. It's not a very comfortable seat, I'm afraid.'" The king threw back his head and roared. His laughter startled a flight of crows from the tall brown grass. They took to the air in a wild beating of wings. "You think I should mistrust Lannister because he sat on my throne for a few minutes? Eh?" He shook with laughter again. "Jaime was all of 17, Ned. Scarce more than a boy."
"Boy or man, he had no right to that throne." "Perhaps he was tired," Robert suggested. "Killing kings is weary work. Gods know there's no place else to rest your ass in that damnable room." And he spoke truly. "It is a monstrous, uncomfortable chair, in more ways than one."
The king shook his head.
"Well, now I know Jaime's dark sin, and the matter can be forgotten. I'm utterly sick of secrets and squabbles and matters of state, Ned. It's all as tedious as counting coppers. Come, let's ride. You used to know how. I want to feel the wind in me hair again.
He kicked his horse back into motion and galloped up over the barrow, raining earth down behind him. For a moment, Ned did not follow. He had run out of words, and he was filled with a vast sense of helplessness. Not for the first time, he wondered what he was doing here and why he had come. He was no John Aaron, to curb the wildness of his king and teach him wisdom. Robert would do what he pleased, as he always had, and nothing Ned could say or do would change that. He belonged in Winterfell. He belonged with Catelyn, in her grief, and with Bran. A man could not always be where he belonged, though. Resigned, Eddard Stark put his boots into his horse and set off after the king. Tyrion. The north went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone, but a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another. They had left Winterfell on the same day as the king, amidst all the commotion of the royal departure, riding out to the sound of men shouting and horses snorting, to the rattle of wagons, and the groaning of the queen's huge wheelhouse, as the light snow flurried about them. The King's Road was just beyond the sprawl of castle and town. There, the banners and the wagons and the columns of knights and free-riders turned south, taking the tumult with them, while Tyrion turned north with Benjen Stark and his nephew. It had grown colder after that, and far more quiet. West of the road were flint hills, grey and rugged, with tall watchtowers on their stony summits. To the east the land was lower, the ground flattening to a rolling plain that stretched away as far as the eye could see. Stone bridges spanned swift, narrow rivers, while small farms spread in rings around holdfasts, walled in wood and stone. The road was well trafficked, and at night, for their comfort, there were rude inns to be found. 3 days' ride from Winterfell, however, the farmland gave way to dense wood, and the King's Road grew lonely. The flint hills rose higher and wilder with each passing mile, until by the fifth day they had turned into mountains, cold blue-grey giants with jagged promontories and snow on their shoulders. When the wind blew from the north, long plumes of ice crystals flew from the high peaks like banners. With the mountains, a wall to the west, the road veered north by northeast, through the wood, a forest of oak and evergreen and black briar that seemed older and darker than any Tyrion had ever seen. The Wolf's Wood, Benjen Stark called it, and indeed their nights came alive with the howls of distant packs, and some not so distant. Jon Snow's albino direwolf pricked up his ears at the nightly howling, but never raised his own voice in reply. There was something very unsettling about that animal, Tyrion thought. There were eight in the party by then, not counting the wolf. Tyrion travelled with two of his own men, as befit a Lannister. Benjen Stark had only his bastard nephew and some fresh mounts for the night's watch, but at the edge of the Wolf's Wood they stayed a night behind the wooden walls of a forest holdfast, and there joined up with another of the Black Brothers, one Yoren. Yoren was stooped and sinister, his features hidden behind a beard as black as his clothing, but he seemed as tough as an old root and as hard as stone. With him were a pair of ragged peasant boys from the Fingers. "Rapers," Yoren said, with a cold look at his charges. Tyrion understood. Life on the Wall was said to be hard, but no doubt it was preferable to castration. Five men, three boys, a direwolf, 20 horses, and a cage of ravens given over to Benjen Stark by Maester Luwin. No doubt They made a curious fellowship for the King's Road, or any road. Tyrion noticed Jon Snow watching Yoren and his sullen companions, with an odd cast to his face that looked uncomfortably like dismay. Yoren had a twisted shoulder and a sour smell. His hair and his beard were matted and greasy and full of lice. His clothing, old, patched, and seldom washed. His two young recruits smelled even worse, and seemed as stupid as they were cruel. No doubt the boy had made the mistake of thinking that the Night's Watch was made up of men like his uncle. If so, Yoren and his companions were a rude awakening. Tyrion felt sorry for the boy. He had chosen a hard life, or perhaps he should say that a hard life had been chosen for him. He had rather less sympathy for the uncle. Benjen Stark seemed to share his brother's distaste for the Lannisters, and he had not been pleased when Tyrion had told him of his intentions. "I warn you, Lannister, you'll find no ends at the wall," he had said, looking down at him.
"No doubt you'll find some place to put me," Tyrion had replied. "As you might have noticed, I'm small."
One did not say no to the Queen's brother, of course. So that had settled the matter. But Stark had not been happy. "You will not like the ride, I promise you that," he said curtly, and since the moment they set out, he had done all he could to live up to that promise. By the end of the first week, Tyrion's thighs were raw from hard riding, his legs were cramping badly, and he was chilled to the bone. He did not complain. He was damned if he would give Benjen Stark that satisfaction. He took a small revenge in the matter of his riding fur, a tattered bearskin, old and musty-smelling. Stark had offered it to him in an excess of Night's Watch gallantry, no doubt expecting him to graciously decline. Tyrion had accepted with a smile. He had brought his warmest clothing with him when they rode out of Winterfell, and soon discovered that it was nowhere near warm enough. It was cold up here, and growing colder. The nights were well below freezing now, and when the wind blew, it was like a knife cutting right through his warmest woolens. By now Stark was no doubt regretting his chivalrous impulse. Perhaps he had learned a lesson. The Lannisters never declined, graciously or otherwise. The Lannisters took what was offered. Farms and holdfasts grew scarcer and smaller as they pressed northward, ever deeper into the darkness of the Wolf's Wood, until finally there were no more roofs to shelter under, and they were thrown back on their own resources. Tyrion was never much use in making a camp or breaking one. Too small, too hobbled, too in the way. So while Stark and Yoren and the other men erected rude shelters, tended to horses, and built a fire, it became his custom to take his fur and a wineskin and go off by himself to read. On the 18th night of their journey, the wine was a rare, sweet amber from the summer isles that he had brought all the way north from Casterly Rock, and the book, a rumination on the history and properties of dragons. With Lord Eddard Stark's permission, Tyrion had borrowed a few rare volumes from the Winterfell Library and packed them for the ride north. He found a comfortable spot just beyond the noise of the camp, beside a swift-running stream with waters clear and cold as ice. A grotesquely ancient oak provided shelter from the biting wind. Tyrion curled up in his fur, with his back against the trunk, took a sip of the wine, and began to read about the properties of dragonbone. "Dragonbone is black because of its high iron content," the book told him. "It is strong as steel, yet lighter and far more flexible, and of course utterly impervious to fire. Dragonbone bows are greatly prized by the Dothraki, and small wonder. An archer so armed can outrange any wooden bow." Tyrion had a morbid fascination with dragons. When he had first come to King's Landing for his sister's wedding to Robert Baratheon,
he had made it a point to seek out the dragon skulls that had hung on the walls of Targaryen's throne room. King Robert had replaced them with banners and tapestries, but Tyrion had persisted until he found the skulls in a dank cellar where they had been stored. He had expected to find them impressive, perhaps even frightening. He had not thought to find them beautiful. Yet they were, as black as onyx, polished smooth, so the bones seemed to shimmer in the light of his torch.